The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Discover a team that's always here to support you at All Care, taking care of communities across Ireland.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show. And yes, in case you're behind the times by an hour, it is 11 o'clock and time to survey the landscape and cast our eye over the state of chassis of everything. The Irish Mail on Sunday has the Beacon on the front page again, and that's the story that keeps on giving or keeps on taking, whatever way you want to look at it. And today, Craig Hughes has that office staff working at the HQ of a leading creche chain, 6 kilometres from the Beacon Hospital, including the chain's CEO, were vaccinated ahead of vulnerable patients in the hospital. The Sunday Times, as that you heard it there on the news from Arlene Foster, and the Sunday Times have it kind of from a slightly different angle, but the same story: Britain to offer Ireland spare COVID vaccines. And what they're suggesting here in the Sunday Times is that 3.7 million COVID jabs to the Republic, and that this could start happening by Easter, they seem to be saying there. And they also have a Beacon story, which is about the chief executive of the Beacon, who travelled to the UK in October, apparently, to compete in a car race. The Sunday Independent, the Beacon, pressure on Beacon to oust CEO as vaccine row escalates. And actually, the first line of this story kind of sums up a lot of things. The state's COVID-19 response descended into chaos yesterday as the vaccination programme at a hospital was suspended and three people absconded from a mandatory hotel quarantine facility a day after the system came into force. And that's... there you go. That's it. The Business Post: limited easing of restrictions as confidence in vaccine rollout drops. So the confidence in vaccine rollout drops is from a Red Sea poll that the Business Post have today. And that shows that there's a sharp rise in public dissatisfaction with the vaccination rollout. So in terms of the easing of restrictions, right, and it is as you'd expect, really, and all the papers have versions of this story, it'll be limited to getting housing construction back up and running, resuming outdoor sports for children, allowing outdoor meetings in parks for people, and relaxing the 5 kilometre travel limit. What is kind of seems to be emerging from sources today is that, you know, a lot of people talk about they'd like to know the plan. Micheál Martin is expected to give a broader outline of the possibility of a wider easing of restrictions in May and then further into the summer. So I suppose to give people a little something to keep them on board. The Irish Sun on Sunday has a very, very sad story on the front. And the headline is, "She's dying before my eyes." And it's a 13-year-old girl. She's being fed through a tube in hospital in Drogheda, County Louth, after she stopped eating due to being called fat on social media. And there is a story of our times, and a very shocking one. And remember a couple of weeks ago here, we were talking about the fact that the age that people are presenting with eating disorder seems to be coming right down, as young as 12 and 13. And I think at the time it was said in the Mail that 16% of the work done in Crumlin's Children's Hospital now is now related to eating disorders. The Sunday World has Kinahan gunman's prison drug plot. And the Daily Star Sunday, which is really, I think they're really building a reputation here for fantastic front pages. They're gone kind of old school, crazy tabloid stuff. Star readers use Geller mind power to fix Suez crisis. Eureka, you move the boat. So that's the readers of the Star helped move the boat. And they're not even put off by the fact that the boat is still stuck there. That's the great thing about it. They're claiming victory from the jaws of defeat there. So there you go. Now, our panel this morning... Dr. Ronan Collins, consultant geriatrician, Brenda Power, columnist with the Irish Daily Mail and the Sunday Times. And joining us remotely is Kevin Cunningham, a lecturer in politics at Technological University in Dublin. Good morning, everyone. And I'll just tell you that the doors are locked in case anyone tries to abscond over the course of the next hour. There is no leaving. Now, look... I suppose we should start with the Beacon story is really has really been exercising everyone over the last few days, and they'll be furious again when they see the front page of the Mail. Ronan Collins, as a medic, what do you make of this?
Well, the first thing, I suppose, when any hospital is in the news like this, the first thing to recognise, and I'm going to say this in fairness of balance, I have no connection with any private hospital, first of all, but there would be a lot of hardworking doctors and nurses who work at that hospital who would be feeling somewhat aggrieved over the way the hospital's reputation is now being sullied. My initial thoughts, so seriously, to take it on a more general level and to get away from the individuality of the Beacon situation, is that the two things that hit me when I read this whole story is that surely there's a clinician in charge of the vaccine programme, and it's the clinician should be deciding where any leftover vaccines would be distributed and who should be getting them. It seems kind of a bizarre kind of governance to have a senior manager deciding who should get the vaccines. It should be a clinician.
Yeah, and all we know is that he did make the phone call to the school, well, apparently, according to the mail, and we don't know
exactly.
That,
but if that's true, I mean, it would seem a strange governance. The second thought occurred to me, and I mean this in a very honest way, no more than I reflected myself when I was offered a vaccine. I'm privileged, I suppose, in one respect, to be a frontline worker, but I did honestly say to myself, should I get it before my parents? Or should I get it before other people who might be more at risk than me? And I took it largely because no more than the flu vaccine every year, because there's an onus on us as healthcare professionals to prevent the transmission of the virus. And as is the case, actually, the vaccine does reduce your chances of transmitting the virus. And I say this because I honestly don't know who took the phone call, or I wasn't privy to it. But in any circumstance like this, if you were offered a vaccine ahead of where you should be in the queue, you would have thought there would have been, particularly people who are in positions of influence, like our teachers are. I mean, I still remember the great teachers I had. They have important, influential and moral authority, particularly over younger people. And I would have thought there would have been some element of reflection about, should I do this? Should I take up this offer? And there would be my thoughts. And I'm not individualising this, because this may happen again. It has happened before, Brendan. And I think people need to kind of just reflect that everybody makes mistakes. And, you know, whether...
It doesn't look like this was a mistake, though.
Well, a mistake in judgment.
There's a bit of a pattern.
There's an error of judgment here. And whether the apology is adequate enough is a matter for the hospital board. I'm not going to get involved in that. But they would be my thoughts on it.
Brenda, your thoughts?
I mean, I depressingly, Brendan, I would say nobody was surprised to learn that there was irregularities in the rollout programme. We had a story, I think, earlier in the year from the Coombe Hospital, where the sons of a senior hospital official were vaccinated because they worked in his private practice. And the whole sort of aura of privilege and entitlement that surrounds private schools and private hospitals is just so reinforced by this. I mean, I completely agree with Ronan. You know, the school has questions to answer as well, because I think any of us, if you were offered a vaccine ahead of more deserving cases in circumstances where you know that it is not your turn, really should have questioned whether or not
if you were told, look, they have vaccines there that are going to be thrown in the bin, they need to get people down, can you get down there now, can you not see the temptation there to go
14 kilometres away? And I see other hospitals, for instance, apparently Merlin Park in Galway has a protocol to offer them to local Gardaí if they have any left over. And I don't believe that they got to 5:30 in the evening and suddenly realised they had a batch of vaccines left over. And the other thing I would ask is, you know, much as I love my kids' teachers, I don't know they'd be the first people to come to mind if I had a batch of spare vaccines to give out. So I think we need some full transparency on who else might have been vaccinated. Yeah. with leftover vaccines in not just this hospital but in other hospitals.
Yeah, there are calls now for an audit at the Beacon, and that's probably not a bad idea, is it, Ronan?
No, I think I would agree with Brenda. I think the important thing is to have a backup list of people who immediately should get the vaccine. You know, you cannot believe that there weren't even people either within an individual hospital or close to it in GP surgeries around in any individual hospital who couldn't have got the vaccine first. So I think that's true. And listen, there does need to be an audit. There are some irregularities and discrepancies in terms of our vaccine rollout, but that's no different from any other jurisdiction in some regards. If you look at a very good article in the New York Times during the week, looking at how vaccine distribution is in New York. And again, there are some lines around that about social class and maybe even race about how vaccine is being distributed or rolled out. But even in Ireland, there's an urban-rural divide. You will see there's a good article in one of the papers there today showing that, for example, many people over 60 in more rural areas have been vaccinated.
That's Nicola Byrne in the Mail on Sunday.
The Mail, exactly.
Look at the draw.
Yeah.
Kevin Cunningham, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at it from a slightly bigger political picture and the outraged response. Like, I'm reminded of that Liveline call when Golfgate emerged. And I just remember and really stuck with me when a woman phoned in and she used that kind of well-known quote, but that, you know, the laws are there for the little people. And the reason why that's kind of stuck with me is because if I go all the way back to the general election in 2020, like, one of the best predictors of why people voted the way they did was in a perception of corruption. And it, I'll be honest, like, it baffled me for months. And I was trying to figure out why was this. And this was from the UCD exit poll. And it said about a quarter of the population believing that corruption was very widespread.
Yeah, and look, let's not link corruption to this too much, because we don't know enough about the story, really. So let's just be very clear that nobody is saying that anything corrupt happened at the Beacon at this point. Yeah?
Of course, yeah, of course. And it's just from a political perspective of how among that subset of voters, Sinn Féin voters were 4 and 5 times more likely to people who thought that way were 4 and 5 times more likely to vote Sinn Féin as opposed to Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. And, you know,
I heard Louise O'Reilly of Sinn Féin on Katie Hannan yesterday, and she was basically saying this is the golden circles, Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, this is what they're all about and everything. So you think that the voters do make that kind of link or leap themselves as well and think this is about the establishment, they're all at it, one set of rules for them?
I think so. Well, I think in relation to the general public seem to respond, you know, universally to these. I mean, there's universal opposition to and appall from Fine Gaelers and Sinn Féiners. But I think the way that they interpret it might be different, because I guess for some people, you know, these incidences of private schools, private healthcare, stockbroking and all that sort of stuff is inaccessible to a subset of the population. Mm. So they might view it quite differently to others who might think of it just as a smaller impurities within that kind of social class.
And so yeah, what do you think, Brenda, that like some people say, well, this is an aberration. It's one guy gone rogue in one situation. Or is this, okay, this is more of it?
I actually do think that it's hard to see how anyone could reach any other conclusion than that this is more of it. Jabs for the boys, you know, the vaccine golden circle. I mean, back when this issue first arose.
Hang on a sec. Most well-off people in this country have not had a vaccination. Most of our politicians have not. Our Taoiseach has not had a vaccination the last time he was asked.
But it's about the optics of it.
I understand the optics, but I'm just saying some kind of general jabs for the boys going on across the vaccination system. That's clearly not happening.
But we don't know whether it is or not. Yeah. I mean, fair play to the Mail for breaking this story, and we don't know what else is to come out. But I mean,
that the Beacon is an aberration in that all the other vaccination centres are run by clinicians and run by the HSE, and there is oversight there.
This
was a unique situation, I think.
It's not sufficiently enforced then, because as I say, back in January when this issue first arose, was the time to put in place a rock solid protocol. What happens if you know by lunchtime, which you would, that you're about to have leftover vaccines? Because apparently what happens is you sometimes get 6 shots from a vial that was only meant to deliver 5. So you'd know by lunchtime how it was looking and people are not turning up again. You should have plenty of time to enforce a protocol that says here is next on the list. I mean, the Beacon is a hospital with people called patients who are surely vulnerable.
It is extraordinary that in a hospital they couldn't find people. No. And again, let it be said, they did go back to the HSE. It was the fault of the HSE portal that they had 200 no-shows on the day. Went back to the HSE and clearly did get 180 deserving cases. But then there seemed to be the rush for everyone to get home at 6 o'clock. People got angry at me yesterday for positing the question that this is all very convenient for the HSE and everybody else and the broader vaccine rollout. When you're in a situation, we found out, courtesy of a PQ by Pádraig Tobin, that 5,000 people in nursing homes still haven't got their second jab. We had this reason this situation occurred is that the portal was giving two appointments to everybody on Tuesday. Like, are there broader problems here as well?
Well, I think the first thing to recognise is that the state has never done a mass vaccine rollout like this. So, of course, there will be teething problems. And, I think the state has done pretty well up to date. I think most of the problems relate to about supply rather than actually administering the vaccines. The reason, apart from the ethics and the moral of it, we're focused so much on the fact that 20 dosages were given to somebody outside of time is because we have so limited of vaccine supply. So let's just recognise that there is a limited supply. Now, there may be, going back to the nursing home issue, there may be reasons why people in nursing homes haven't been vaccinated yet. For example, you can't vaccinate someone when they're unwell.
Well, according to Pádraig Tobin, there are 100 people who didn't get vaccinated because they're unwell, but there are 5,000 people waiting for their second jab still.
And that may well be the case. And there may be logistical issues. There are logistical issues. For example, again, it was highlighted in the paper about Nicola Byrne's article about the way this has been rolled out this day. I'm not too sure, for example, that rolling it out to a large section of the population through general practice is the most efficient way to do this.
Why do you
or
say
the
that?
Easiest way to do this? Well, first of all, to give the vaccine, you have to have people socially distanced. You then have to have people waiting for 15 minutes afterwards, so to make sure they haven't had a reaction to it. And many of the practices aren't built in order to accommodate people like in that manner. And then you have to realise the impact of that on the rest of our primary care system. Let's not forget, that heart disease, alarm symptoms for cancer, serious depression and mental illness during this current pandemic and other healthcare issues aren't still going on here. And that primary care has to get on with its normal business as well. But the second thing and the most frustrating thing that general practitioners would be reflecting back to me is, number one, being told you are getting X amount of vaccine, setting up a clinic to deliver this to X amount of patients, and then being told a few hours beforehand or the evening beforehand, no, actually, you're only going to get X percent of the vaccine.
Yeah, yeah,
and then trying to decide who gets the vaccine and who doesn't. And so there are difficulties. But again, most of that relates to our supply of vaccine. And that is the biggest problem.
Yeah, which is not going to be a problem anymore from what we hear. It seems to be oodles and noodles of it coming from here on in. I think the problem will become, how do we get it out? Brenda, what do you make of the front of the Sunday Times today, Britain to offer Ireland spare COVID vaccines?
Yeah, I was just thinking, this is a total win-win for Boris, isn't it, really? Not only does he get to...
win-win for us as well.
Well, absolutely, but thumb his nose at the EU, because this is going to upset the EU's rollout programme, which hasn't exactly covered the Union in glory. The rationale, obviously, is that this is an island and the rollout here is obviously hampering efforts to open up the north of Ireland. So it makes sense for them to offer us. Apparently they have something like 100 million surplus vaccinations. So they could easily...
They will at some stage. In as much as we'll have millions of extra ones too at some stage.
But they reckon they'll have them in the next couple of months or so.
I
can't see any reason why this isn't something to be welcomed, except of course the EU will not be best pleased about it, because it will cast into stark relief their own failure to get the vaccine out. But it's good news, as you say.
Yeah, good news, Ronan.
Very good news.
Yeah.
And closer cooperation between the two countries. We have a shared border. I think there's a very real danger if the North gets very far ahead of us in terms of vaccination, that you'll have to try and police the border from people wanting to go north or go out in a restaurant. I mean, they may be opening up far before we can, and that will create a clear tension across the border, I think.
But I mean, the rationale of it is, as you say, it's very clear. You know, there's a quote here in the Sunday Times from Sir Jeremy Farrar, a scientist on the SAGE team in the UK, who says, "The world will not be safe while any single country is still fighting the virus. If it's left to spread, it risks mutating." So, I mean, it's plain common sense for the North, for the UK to share.
Absolutely. Well, we would say that, wouldn't we? There you go. OK. Now, speaking of the opening up, I want to bring in now Professor Cliona Ní Chealaigh, who's a consultant in inclusion health and infectious diseases at St James's Hospital and associate professor in clinical medicine in Trinity College, Dublin. Cliona, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good, thanks, Cliona. I suppose there's a general view around the place now that we're not going to get it lower than 500 seems to be the new attitude. And this is as good as it gets. And people have had enough, so we need to start opening up. Are you worried about this kind of general consensus that seems to have taken hold now?
I mean, yeah, I think, you know, if you look, people, whatever the latest poll I saw was 82% were in favour of maintaining or increasing restrictions if they're needed. But people absolutely are so tired. I know myself, I am so sick of the restrictions. And I think, you know, again, now is a good moment to pause and see how we can do that in the safest way possible. And there are things that we could do now that will make that safer, and we need to do them.
And what are those things?
So one of them will be setting up a really good IT system that tracks, you know, where, first of all, it could be used to track outbreaks and see where things are spreading, because we don't know that at the moment. And it could also be used to track things like vaccines. I think, you know, that's been exposed with what happened in the Beacon, with all the difficulty with vaccination. It's showing our weakness of not having a centralised computer system where every person living in Ireland is registered on there with their medical conditions. So that's something we
could start building.
That's
going to take years, presumably,
well,
at the rate
really?
We set up IT
companies
systems.
Fly through things. You know, if we got some of the IT companies that are based here in Ireland, get Google or somebody on it.
Yeah,
You know, it's not that difficult, actually. And most GP surgeries have electronic systems. It would just be a question of sucking all that up, you know, from the systems, having an interface that can suck that up and merge it. So, you know, and when is a better time to get started on that than now? I don't think there is a better time. So that would be one thing. We really need to resource our public health teams, our population health, you know, specialties. We haven't done that. I can't understand why. We really need to do that and do that backwards tracking, see where things are still spreading.
Yeah, which they are starting to do, I believe, this week,
starting,
isn't it?
But slowly, you know, very slowly. And there's still bits of it, like having the public health doctors be consultants, which would mean they can come on the radio and the telly and speak like I can and my consultant colleagues can. They can't because they don't have consultant status. So there are things like that that would definitely help. And then mask wearing in schools. I know I've been harping on about this for months, but I don't understand why kids in primary school aren't wearing masks. You know, it reduces the risk. It's like trying not to get sunburnt when you go out in the sun. Wear your long sleeve t-shirt, wear your sunscreen, limit your time. You need to do all of those things, not just one.
Cliona, are you worried about the schools reopening?
Yes. I'd be very worried about them not reopening. And again, it's always that risk-benefit. But yeah, I think, you know, there are some concerning indications. So that's why we need to do everything we can to keep it safe and keep them open rather than shutting them again, because we know that that has very serious consequences for lots of kids.
We're back as well in a point that we get to periodically, right, where 90% of the people are saying, well, hang on a minute, I'm keeping these restrictions in level 5. I'll keep them as well in level 3. I'd keep them in level 10. But there are 10% of people who aren't going to keep them whatever. So why keep putting more and more restrictions on me when some people, and we're seeing, and Pete Lunn, who always denies that there's anyone not keeping the restrictions, is now admitting himself even that this has doubled in the last month or so, I think, of people calling around to each other's houses. Is that becoming now a problem? I mean, presumably that's how it's happening, because when they're asked at the press conference, and there's usually a public health doctor there now, I noticed the last couple of weeks, and they're asked, how is this happening? They're saying people are going around to each other's houses, people are having play dates, is the latest thing we heard last week. So basically, these cases are being caused by people breaking the restrictions, yes?
Yeah, but also by people going into to work, essential workers, and they're having their break or their lunches indoors without their masks. You know, shops, all the activity that's still going on. And this new variant is so transmissible. It is like, I don't know what, like, you know, the Duracell bunny of COVID viruses. So, yeah, I mean, people, I suppose even more worried than I am about play dates, I'm worried about people travelling in and not quarantining properly.
Yeah.
Because whatever about the consequences of the play date and, you know, somebody getting COVID in that household and getting really sick, importing in that, you know, for example, that P1 variant that they have in Brazil could be potential catastrophe, and we already have it in the country. So I think we need to recognise what are the most dangerous things, and definitely one of the most dangerous things is that travelling in and not quarantining, and that is happening.
Okay. Cliona, will you stay with us? And I just want to bring in the panel here. Brenda, in terms of this, the easing of restrictions that we're all kind of, I don't know, looking forward to, that people are seemingly clamouring for now or whatever. What do you think?
It doesn't seem to be much to look forward to, I have to say. The papers seem to be generally agreeing that we're talking about a possible restriction of the 5K travel limit, a return to housing, certain housing construction, resuming outdoor sports for children and allowing people to meet outdoors in park. People are already doing that. Mm. And I mean, just coming back to what Cliona's point there about, you know, the fact that we're blaming house visits and play dates and so on for the increase in community transmissions. I wonder, are we just sort of looking at the fact that people admitted to the ESRI that 5% were visiting friends' houses in January and now it's 10% and making that leap? Because previously we were told it was house parties and it was shebeens that were responsible for the increases and the spikes in numbers. We don't have adequate contact tracing to tell us exactly where the spikes are coming from or where the transmission is coming from. So are these just educated guesses? I suspect that they probably are. And I think for a year into this, I think most people have internalised safe behaviour, even if they are visiting one another's houses.
Okay, is what you're saying is that most people really know how to behave properly without there being a lockdown on the whole country?
Well, you see, the whole aim of the lockdown, I think Luke O'Neill touches on this in the Indo again today, was basically, and Leo Varadkar has said it in the past, was to get the transmission level, to get the numbers in hospital to a level where it wouldn't overwhelm.
Mary Horgan, who is on NPHET, said it here yesterday as well.
It wouldn't overwhelm the health service. I think there was something like, was it 300 people in hospital yesterday with COVID or in ICU compared to 2,000 in January.
The 300 in hospital, I think about 60 to 70 in ICU.
164, I think, in ICU yesterday. And the median age is 32. So older people obviously are being protected by the vaccine. The risk is coming down. But, you know, Luke O'Neill says pandemics like this do not end with a bang. They don't end with a big nuclear wipeout of the bacterium. They end when the healthcare system is no longer threatened. Simple as that. When excess deaths fall to manageable normal levels. That's what we've got to aim for, I think, with the lifting of lockdown. Otherwise, we're going into a cycle of lockdown, spike, repeat. And I was just looking...
Do you think we should be opening up more on April 5th?
I think we should certainly be looking at imaginative ways to open up. For example, in Barcelona yesterday, they tried an experiment with 5,000 people unmasked attending an open-air concert. What happened was they all got an antigen test, a rapid antigen test yesterday morning. If that test was clear, and that is a high reliability rate, their tickets were validated and they went along. And the idea is, how safe are you?
Okay. Cliona, would you be happy with 5,000 people going to a concert antigen tested?
So I'd be really happy if it was well ventilated, if it was outdoors,
people
were standing apart, you know, there was plenty of air near a beach or something, near the sea, get a good wind going. That would really reassure me.
And you'd be okay with that, and the antigen test would give you comfort enough there?
It's that extra layer. The antigen test wouldn't give me a huge amount of comfort. The ventilation would give me more comfort, but add on the antigen testing and maybe tracking and seeing. Hopefully they're tracking. If it was an experiment, they'll better have their results and their data to look at. You know, that you have all those measures in place.
So you're not quite suggesting we have the electric picnic yet, but maybe we could try and be a little bit
outdoor
more...
Outdoors. Focus on outdoors and do as much as you can outdoors. You know, you can wear masks outdoors and then that adds that extra level of safety. There's loads of things you can do to make outdoors safer, and it's already pretty safe.
Ronan Collins, I suppose there's a view abroad that... I mean abroad in this country, that... We got such a fright at Christmas and that the politicians got such a land that they'll never stand up to NPHET again, and that we have now gone too cautious on our reopening plans.
Yeah, I mean, just to go back to Cliona's comments there initially, I would agree with much of what's been said. First of all, I don't think you need to be a consultant to be allowed on the radio to talk, and I think public health specialists can come on the radio
and talk. They have to be cleared by the HSE, so they're not allowed to talk independently. It's in our contract. From my public health colleagues, that's what stopped them.
Oh, well, and that's an interesting theme, because that's going to come up later in the show, I'm sure, about the independence of doctors from their employers. But in any case, I do think there should be more public health voice and also epidemiological voices on the radio here. Now, going back to the concert suggestions, Brendan, that might work well for Handel, but I don't see it working for the Arctic Monkeys with everybody standing 2.5 metres apart in an open sea area. But in any case, The broader point is that we have to learn to live with the virus. And if you look at the patterns of all previous pandemics, you tend to get a pretty predictable three-wave response. There's the initial outbreak, there's then a worse outbreak, usually around winter time, and there's probably a further kind of spike then coming into summertime. And then, as Brenda says, through a variety of various reasons, you kind of people learn to live with it, the mortality, the figures fall, vaccination takes place, or just herd immunity or whatever, and we move on with things. And I think it is right, we do have to get the level down to an acceptable level, but we do have to live with this. There are issues here. I think the government at Christmas tried to give, to sustain the effort as well, even though it did backfire to a certain degree, to sustain the effort, I think the government had to do something to allow people a little bit of laxity. Did it cost us? Yes. But you were talking about on a population basis in order to sustain a very difficult effort, you know, that people did need some a break. And I do think as we approach the summer, and I was listening to my colleague Mary Horgan yesterday, I do think we can allow outdoor activities. I do think we should be looking at outdoor dining. I do think we should be looking at factors like this.
But not yet.
Well, not yet.
I think what we're being told is hold the line.
But the roadmap is very important here, yeah. Brendan. And the public need to be...
And you think it's important? It seems to be now that we will be getting some kind of a roadmap on Tuesday.
But more important than that, I think the government need to specifically tell the people our targets for vaccination, because once the high-risk cohort are vaccinated, the rest of us can and indeed must actually get back to actually resurrecting society and getting back to living.
Yeah, OK. Cliona mentioned the mandatory hotel quarantine there, and obviously we have begun it. The plane hadn't landed, but there was a family member of one family on to Claire Byrne on the radio pointing out that they had been in Dubai for an hour and a half and they'd gone to McDonald's. And the next day, yesterday evening, that same family were on the news in this pokey little room, five of them. There's a very small number of people there. Some of them have run away already. I think they found two of them now. So there's one back. Brenda, what do you make of all this?
Well, you know, I'm sorry for that family. It did look from the video as though they were in pretty cramped circumstances. But, you know, we've spent months bellyaching about not having a COVID vaccination or quarantine system. Like, for instance, they had in Australia a blanket imposition on everybody coming into the country that you quarantine and that's the end of it. It was inevitable as soon as we introduced it, a limited version of it, because, you know, not a handful of countries, but a handful of countries to whom people come regularly to Ireland from on the list, that someone would be bellyaching about the conditions. I mean, you don't have to go via Dubai if you're coming from Australia. They could have flown to London and come via there. So, I mean, I don't understand.
Okay, well, we don't know what flights were available, but they knew
the rules.
Yeah, well, I think that in fairness, they had planned to come. The rules did come in quite suddenly in the end when they came in, and they have been given a bigger room, yeah. a more suitable room.
I admired their honesty. Do you know what I mean? Many people could have taken a different route and landed and said nothing. And going back to the point about mandatory quarantine, you know the Australians' approach to nothing to declare, people who watch that programme, and their border controls are very tight. But I think Niall Conroy's an excellent piece in the Sunday Business Post. If we really want to tackle this pandemic seriously, we have to have mandatory quarantine and it has to be run by healthcare professionals, not by bureaucracy. That would be my one view. I think it should be easily possible to trace where a person has come through, their passport being swiped internationally now to see where people have actually tracked through. I think people need education when they arrive as to why they're being quarantined, so people understand why they're being asked to do this, and also they need to be given adequate facilities. I think that room for five people was really stretching it a bit. And the other bit is that all outbreaks are local. And if you read Mark Rowe's piece about the W Health Organization, the critical thing to tackling this is the tracing and isolating on a local business so you can actually clamp down on any outbreak quickly. And if you look at Australia, people in Sydney, despite the floods and the mice plagues and the other biblical stuff going on in Australia, people are going out to dinner. You know, there was a colleague of mine writing, I think, or a former Kinsale friend of mine writing in the Examiner during the week saying, you know, that life in Sydney is almost back to normal. And really our approach is not going to be successful until we have a proper single agency, mandatory quarantine, and we've got proper focus on local identification and clampdown on outbreaks.
Because that seems to be one of the problems with this, as Ronan was saying there, that nobody seems to be 100% sure who is responsible for these people being in a position
to get away. They were out for a walk.
They were out for a walk. But apparently when the security, I see again the Mail has this story, when the security firm, the private security firm, were contacted to ask, well, who's watching these people, they referred to the Department of Health. The Department of Health, I think, referred to the Defence Forces, who referred back to the Department of Health. So nobody seems to be 100% sure who is actually policing this.
And actually, can I just say, there was a conversation about this earlier in the week, right? And we were kind of left none the wiser by it. But just, we pulled a couple of clips of this, right? Because, so last Tuesday on the Claire Byrne programme, the independent TD Cathal Berry, who is, ex-military, he outlined as he saw it what the role of private security and the defence forces in the mandatory hotel quarantine system, right? So we listened to Cathal Berry first.
The private security personnel, who would be quite numerous, I suspect, at the facility, they would be able to do a citizen's arrest, call the members of the Garda Síochána, the guards come and do a formal arrest from there. So that's how I'd see it playing out. A citizen's arrest by the private security firm and then a handover to the Garda Síochána. One person in a hotel wouldn't be sufficient for any kind of role like that. So the function of the Defence Forces is administrative, it's supervisory and it's liaisonic.
Okay, so that was his view on it, very reasonable. Then on the same programme, Antoinette Cunningham of the AGSI came on and said this.
A citizen's arrest can only be carried out in very clear circumstances, and of course a citizen's arrest carries a risk with it. The reason Gardaí have powers is we're protected in the course of acting under those powers. So citizen's arrest is not as simplistic as just putting your hand on somebody's shoulder and saying, I'm making a citizen's arrest. There has to be a whole pile of conditions attached to that, and one has to be very sure that if they're going to detain and take the liberty of somebody else, that they're acting in accordance with legal guidelines before they do that. So citizen's arrest is just probably not just as simplistic as that, and I wonder if that is the instruction that the Defence Forces have actually got.
And you see, I didn't hear any more about the conversation after. I don't know if the conversation went any further. It was left hanging there. Kevin Cunningham, you're back with us. What are your thoughts on this whole our own unique situation around mandatory quarantine, how it's working?
Well, I mean, we're not inventing the wheel with the mandatory quarantine. I mean, luckily enough, obviously other countries have done it and relatively successfully, with obviously a lot of difficulties. I mean, I don't think introducing anything like this is going to be plain sailing. It's clearly something that's important because of these new variants, because there is concern that there could be a variant at some point that might jump the vaccines or whatever. So it's obviously very important to try to keep an eye and restrict those sorts of variants. But I think with all this and with the beacon situation and all that, a lot of it seems to be just down to the execution of these new sorts of things that government is trying to have to do. And, you know, it's important to kind of scrutinize these things, but we're going to have, you know, errors here and there. And broadly speaking, I think, you know, that's just a kind of teething process. So, I'm quite positive on the idea that that will work. I'm quite positive on the idea that the vaccines will roll out, you know, over the next month or so, and that things will start to get better more generally, you know.
Yeah. And look, we do tend to get caught up and have a frenzy around all the things that go wrong. And there is a vast tide of things going right. Professor Cliath Ní Chealaigh, before we let you go, is the mandatory quarantine system that we have in place, is that adequate for if we get numbers down more and people coming in from abroad could have more of an impact, A, on numbers, and B, obviously, if the variants, you know, which the South African is on the growth in certain areas around Europe and stuff. Are we looking at having to get into a much tougher and broader mandatory quarantine situation, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I think if we get to the, you know, position that where we were in the summer, and to some degree where we were in the autumn, you know, if we had dealt with that, if we dealt with incoming travel, we wouldn't have seen any further waves. So absolutely, we need to address it. And it's unfortunate that you can't trust people to stick to quarantine properly in their own homes. But I think we've seen that you can't.
It's listen, you can't trust them to stick to it in the hotel by the looks of things.
You know, a couple of
even with the might of the armed forces, private security, citizens' arrest, everything.
Imagine the scenes.
Yeah. Well, listen, I suppose, look, if we can't manage it with 17 people off a flight to Dubai, this is like the vaccines. When we get to 1 million a month on the mandatory hotel quarantine, we'll see how it works then. Okay, Professor Cleanan Ekalig, thank you very much.
Thank you.
By the way, I just want to say, somebody I kind of misspoke, I think, when talking about the Daily Mail and Mail on Sunday stories about the Beacon earlier and used the word if about whether or not aspects of it are true. We weren't in any way questioning the veracity of the article. Somebody probably being super careful in their speech or whatever, but not casting any aspersions on those excellent stories. Okay, we'll take a break. Our panel staying with us, Dr. Ronan Collins, Brenda Power and Kevin Cunningham. We'll talk to you in a second.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Our panel still with us, Dr. Ronan Collins, Brenda Power and Kevin Cunningham. But now I want to talk to Adam Harris, founder and CEO of As I Am, which is Ireland's national autism charity. Adam, you have a piece in today's Mail on Sunday, and it's your response to this week's RTE Investigates revelations about those dossiers being kept by the state on autistic children who were engaged in litigation. What was your reaction to those revelations this week, Adam?
You know, I think there's just a sense generally of being truly sickened within the autism community. I mean, trust is a rare commodity for families with additional needs, because the reality is that trust is something that is earned. And for most families, really from the word go, when you start on the journey of an autism diagnosis or indeed another disability diagnosis, you aren't really given a reason to trust. Soft barriers are put up. Rights that are meant to be provided for are often blocked as opposed to vindicated by the state. So I think while people may not have been surprised by these revelations, they were sickened to see the extent of them. I think it's important to note that the cases that were documented in RTE Investigates really look at maybe 50 cases from the early 2000s and the late 90s. But what I think is most concerning about this issue is the response of the department itself. Because from what we've heard from the department is we're not talking about something that's historic, a practice that we'll put an end to, that should never have happened. Instead, we're being told this is normal. This is how litigation works.
And they have said as well that they had a senior counsel in to look at it and that it is all entirely legal.
Well, I think the problem is, should we really be having this discussion about whether something is legal or not? To begin with, I think the legality is very, very questionable, because while it might be normal for co-defendants to share information, it certainly isn't normal for doctor-patient confidentiality to be breached without consent, or indeed for the constitutional rights of the family to be so infringed upon. But I think this goes much, much more deep. I think what we need to talk about is why were the cases involved suing the state in the first place? These were children with additional needs who weren't being provided a basic education, who didn't have access to the most basic therapeutic support. The state dragged them through the courts, and not only did it do that, while doing it, it was building up a picture of the family and trying to take advantage of people when they were at their most vulnerable. I think that's really, really worrying, and it really shows that we need a deep cultural reset in how we treat children with additional needs and their families here in Ireland.
Okay, and what would a cultural reset look like?
So I think at the start we need to look at why are we here, and that's because we're not investing enough resources. Families have had to take these actions because the government has consistently decided not to provide support for the most vulnerable, but also to actually invest its resources in blocking as opposed to vindicating rights. I think for many families there's a sense of from the get-go, as opposed to being a partner on this journey, an expert by experience, you're actually, there's a sense that you're the enemy, that you're somehow trying to undermine the system and people push back against you. So I think there is a need for, from what we've heard from the department so far, I know the Taoiseach has launched a review, but I don't think that goes far enough. We need to have an independent investigation that needs to tell us, is this still happening today? Is there anyone else affected? I think first and foremost, we need to prioritise the 50 families we know about. They need to be informed. That needs to be the priority, but they also need to be supported. Because I think this will be a very traumatic event for many. But I think we need to go far beyond that. We're very good at being horrified in hindsight. Yeah. How do we make sure that children aren't treated like this moving forward?
Yeah, someone pointed out to me the other day that all the shock horror about this, that a lot of those people didn't say a word when 20,000 children who were in mainstream classes, children with special needs, were quietly dropped off the return to education recently. That, you know, we're great, as you say, to jump up and down in at moments like this. But what you're saying is that we need to remember this and use it to effect broader change, is it?
I think what we need to look at is we've never prioritised children with additional needs, be it in the return to school at present, be it the fact that there's children waiting 40 months, in excess of 40 months for early intervention service at the time. and be at his children today without a suitable school place. That's before we even talk about how when you reach 16 or 18, it's like you no longer have any support needs and families worry about what will happen when I'm gone. So we really need to ask ourselves, as a republic, do we cherish the children of the nation equally? And I think what we need to use this as an opportunity is to show families that the state now deserves trust. And that's by having accountability, having an investigation, and putting our money where our mouth is and supporting families who need it.
Adam, can I just ask you finally, in your community and to the people and families you've been talking to, is this going to damage people's trust with the services they're accessing and the people they're dealing with?
I think so, and I think we have to look at trust has been damaged a number of times already. We've seen a lot of problems in recent months with the assessment and need process. We've seen problems in recent years with HSE and TUSLA and the sharing of information. So I think it's really important that we all work hard now to rebuild that trust, particularly as we come into World Autism Month next week. What I would say to families who are worried, and I can understand that worry this week, we're here to support. We're holding a support webinar for families to come and ask questions on Tuesday evening.
Okay.
So if people are interested, they come to their to our website and we'd be delighted to support them and provide more information.
Adam, stay there a minute. Ronan, as a doctor, what do you make of what happened?
Well, as articulated, I think Adam has hit the nail on the head. I think there's very little I could add to it other than to say when I watched the programme, it's an appalling spectre, really, to think that an official department of the state is building up a dossier on children. Really appalling. I think Adam has hit the nail on the head, though, that our attitude here, and not just with regard to children with autism, but children who have other impairments at birth, we seem to get into this adversarial thing straight away as to who caused it, who's responsible, who's going to look after our children's needs. Instead of the state standing up straight away in all these situations and saying that we value our children inherently as a society and that we are going to make sure that our children are going to get whatever they need in terms of care, whatever they need in terms of assessment, support, financial aid and security going forward.
I suppose, yeah, people would say there aren't unlimited resources
for this.
And I suppose the argument that the HSE and the Department of Education were doing here is that they have a duty to protect public coffers against
these cases. I would contend it's costing us more than where we're going about it at the moment.
Yeah.
I would contend it. But the other point I would make, which is also worrying and goes back to my point a little bit about earlier, I was saying about the independence of physicians from their employees. Lawyers, and there may be some grain of the waters here. The only situation I could see where a medical report would find its way into the Department of Health in a legal process is where you're actually the patient or the child and their parents are aware that they're being assessed by a doctor who's acting for the Department of Health's legal team.
Yeah, I think the lawyer whose name escapes, you know, who represents a lot of families in cases like this, was talking yesterday, and he did say there is a process here whereby we have a file built up. The department asks us if they can access it. We ask the family if they're okay with us sharing the file and the child with the department, and that's how it's supposed to work. So his point is, clearly, has this been a charade all these years? Brenda?
With Mr. Cantlin.
It was Ernest Cantlin, yeah.
Well, I mean, nobody can argue with what Adam had to say there. The scandal here is that children with autism and their parents have to go to court in some circumstances to get the help they need. But, you know, when you talk about secret dossiers and intelligence dossiers, that all sounds very Stasi-like. But in fact, what you're talking about, as far as I can see, is legal defence files. And when
you are talking about them going to doctors and going to a psychiatrist, certainly in one instance, and saying, tell us what you've learned about these families in the room.
Right. What they should have been told was, absolutely, what they should have been told was, go and get a court order, or I'll have to consult my clients. The difficulty here is with whoever handed this information over. They're the ones who breach confidentiality, not the lawyers. They're absolutely entitled. When you enter the adversarial legal system, you have two sets of legal teams pitted against each other, both of them with an absolute imperative to do what they can to damage the other case.
I think nobody is pointing any finger at lawyers, because we wouldn't dare.
No.
But I think people are asking why the Department of Health, the HSE and the Department of Education used a situation where they were providing support to these children and used that against them then.
But who handed those files over? Who gave those files to the lawyers? Somebody had to. So those are the people they have the beef okay. with, not the department.
Okay, Adam, do you want to have a last word on that?
Yeah, I think the starting point of this is the fact that the department even asked. I think that's where the really sinister behaviour sets in. We've heard a lot about duty and we've heard senior civil servants talk about that all week. Their first duty is actually to implement the law, piece of the law like the Disability Act, which even today, the HSE constantly drags families through the courts to breach the law. So our funding all of the time, our taxpayers' money, is used to deny rights as opposed to vindicate rights. And that's the scandal here.
OK, thanks, Adam. Kevin Cunningham, you wanted to have a word on this.
Oh, just that the clinicians are, you know, they are dependent on HSE, you know, so they're not exactly as independent on being able to kind of give that information, obviously, so they're kind of the department. At least, so.
You can imagine how complex relationships are there. Okay, yeah. Adam Harris, founder and CEO of As I Am, thank you very much. And we're going to move on from that. And Kevin, I'll stick with you. There's a poll in the Business Post today, Red Sea poll, and it's, you know, there's the politics with a capital P of the state of the parties, but it takes in a lot of other stuff as well. And you are, as we have a polling expert on the show, would you tell us what you think is significant in the poll today?
Yeah, I tell you, I mean, there's a couple of really interesting things. It's the Red Sea Business Post poll. One of the things was obviously, I mean, we've talked about the vaccine, but how 67% think that the government's not doing a good job on that vaccine rollout, which is up from 47%. And that includes, you know, quite a lot of Fine Gael voters, like a majority of Fine Gael's supporters are also in that mindset. And I think that's quite interesting. You know, they're not actually blaming the EU to the same extent. There seems to be 47% who would kind of attribute some blame to the EU, but that's a little bit more balanced, which is interesting, because at the end of the day, our vaccine rollout is not really significantly different from other European countries, because we have about 13% of the population vaccinated. The EU average is 12%, and bar Hungary and Malta, there isn't really much of a difference.
Okay, is it because we're seeing the UK next to us, or do you think is it partially the tenor of the conversation around everything here at the moment, which is can tend towards the anxious and angry and everything else?
I think the UK bit is a much bigger feature of all of this. The fact that Britain are vaccinating, because they're kind of retaining more of their vaccines, but they're vaccinating a lot more. And you can see that also in support for Boris Johnson over the way that his support has actually started to increase a little bit.
Okay, now, and listen,
that doesn't mean that...
I
was going to say that it doesn't mean that, like, when we get our numbers up, that, you know, this government is going to see their numbers increase. You know, like Fianna Fáil are down at 11%. This isn't the worst in their series, but it's relatively low. But we've seen that, you know, in Israel, with the Israeli government obviously really rolled out their vaccine. And they didn't get, the Israeli government didn't get a boost in their latest elections.
So like the last government handled Brexit so well, and they never got the thank you. There might not be a big thank you for the vaccine.
There might not. Yeah. Yeah, because, I mean, at the end of the day, Johnson's figures have gone up, but they've only gone up to the bottom of where he was at the end of the first wave. Like, he had one of these kind of boosts from all the actions that the UK government took back in March. But his support had declined very severely. So he's popular now more popular than he was maybe a couple of months ago, but not really no more popular than Boris Johnson was before the pandemic struck. So I think there's a lot there. Yeah.
And Brenda, you were looking at the poll as well. Happiness levels plummeting, probably not a great surprise.
Absolutely. I mean, we usually top international polls of happiness levels. But something like 63% of women in the 18 to 24 age group are now reporting that they're unhappy. I don't think that, again, should come as a surprise to anybody, that levels of happiness are declining, and especially in women, because they're the ones taking the brunt of the homeschooling, the management of houses, of simply looking after kids and trying to work at home.
Yeah.
I think that's something that has to be factored in to the opening of up of society. You know, what can you do?
Any idea of what could we do? Yeah.
But I mean,
I know it's not up to Brenda Power, but any thoughts, welcome.
No, but I mean, when you had a woman on yesterday, for instance, from the Hairdressing Institute, you know, I think there is a sense that because salons and hairdressing is a kind of a predominantly a female concern, that really it's not something, it's not as important as opening the golf clubs, for example. But actually, as she was making the point,
many women play golf as well. I mean, no matter what we say here, there will be people getting out, so let's just cover as many bases as we can.
Not to sound trivial, but I mean, that is a very important outlet for women. It's a very important self-esteem issue to be able to get your hair done, whatever. You had, that lady said that she had older people who are simply not, Lisa, not capable of washing their own hair. But I mean, I know in the local hairdresser that I used to go to, the outing for the older ladies particularly, the chance to meet and have a chat, a cup of tea and a read of a magazine was secondary to getting their hair done. You know, I mean, I know it sounds trivial and people say, oh, well, you know, well, what about the churches? What about non-essential shops? But little things like that give people a boost. They absolutely do. And not being able to get out, get your hair done, have a cup of coffee with a friend is bound to impact on mental health and happiness levels. And it is. It clearly is.
Okay. Now, I think a lot of people will agree with that suggestion, but I'm conscious you're not a doctor, so I'm going to take medical opinion on it. Ronan Collins, should we in some way think about how women can do something like get their hair done, and maybe if they're vaccinated?
Yeah, I think, again, going back to the happiness issue, it clearly is going to become a problem. I think the levels of mental stress and ill health are probably building. It's probably a wave we won't fully see for a couple of months, but I do think we need to move on. I think opening up, for example, tennis, I think golf, fishing, if nothing else, to get the women's husbands away from them for a few hours might cheer them up a bit.
Indeed, it might cheer up both parties, but
exactly. But I do think Brenda's suggestion about, you know, some amenity in life, and we need to look at how we can restore amenity to people in as safe a way as possible. But again, it boils down to simple things. You vaccinate people who are most at risk, you have a mandatory quarantine system, and you crack down on local outbreaks and get on top of this as quickly as possible. And that's all doable, actually.
When you put it like that, okay, it's a no-brainer. All right, thanks very much, Dr. Ronan Collins. Thank you, Brenda Power, and thank you, Kevin Cunningham.